This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Hi, how's it going? Coming up on the report, when Welch's, the grape juice company, rinses out its tanks, there's a little residual juice in that juice, a sugar, and the company is feeding that sugar to hydrogen-producing bacteria. So in essence, it's converting waste juice into fuel. I'll let you know about that. And abandoned tires are landing on your doorstep.
One large room of this multi-purpose factory is used to shred the formerly discarded tires into thick rubber strips. The strips are then hole punched, fixed together with three metal rods, and designed with colorful plastic beads. The end result is a custom-made doormat made out of recycled tires.
But first, here are some of the stories we've been following. President Bush is echoing his past calls to wean the country from foreign oil, but his most recent State of the Union speech quickly brushed over the topics of energy independence and global warming. The president says the U.S. is committed to energy security and confronting global climate change.
And the best way to meet these goals is for America to continue leading the way toward the development of cleaner and more energy-efficient technology.
The president called specifically for funding new clean coal technology. That came at the same time his energy department pulled funding for a project that did exactly that. We'll have more on that story a little later. Mr. Bush called for increased use of renewable power and nuclear power to reduce greenhouse gases. He also called for better battery technology and renewable fuels for automobiles, but did not mention any additional government support for research on those topics. A proposed investment in clean energy in developing countries and completing an international agreement on global warming was noted by environmental groups in a positive way, but then they turned around and criticized the Bush administration for not implementing a mandatory greenhouse gas cap and trade program. Well, the U.S. Department of Energy is pulling the plug on a state-of-the-art power plant that was intended to demonstrate how coal could be burned cleanly. Amanda Vinicky has the latest on that.
The FutureGen plant would burn coal without pollution by sequestering carbon emissions underground. President Bush called for FutureGen 5 years ago and repeated support for this kind of project in his recent State of the Union speech.
Let us fund new technologies that can generate coal power while capturing carbon emissions.
But the Department of Energy says because of ballooning costs, it's backing out. Illinois Republican State Senator Dale Ryder says it could kill the project planned for his state.
It was the right thing to do in order to find new ways to produce energy using 21st century technology. That idea is more expensive, as everyone would know it would be, but it's still the right thing to do.
Congress could still salvage the FutureGen project. For the Environment Report, I'm Amanda Vinicky.
Some states are considering a ban on milk carton labels that say the milk is free of added hormones. But one state has reversed such a ban. Julie Grant reports.
Recombinant bovine growth hormone, sometimes called RBST, occurs naturally in cattle. Monsanto created a synthetic version in the mid-1990s. It forces cows to produce about an extra gallon of milk a day. But more consumers are asking for milk that's not produced by injecting the synthetic hormone. The Pennsylvania Agriculture Department had previously said it would not allow milk companies to label products RBST-free. Ohio and New Jersey have both been considering similar bans. But after consumer outcry, Pennsylvania reached a compromise. Companies in that state can now use the hormone-free label, but they must also say that, quote, no significant difference has been shown between milk from cows injected or not injected with RBST. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
A little later in the report, we'll have more information on what exactly is organic milk and how some farms are shopping around for lenient organic certifiers. Infants are widely exposed to a class of chemicals that might be harmful to their reproductive systems. That's according to new research published this week in the journal Pediatrics. Mark Brush reports the chemicals are known as phthalates.
Phthalates are everywhere. They're used to make plastic softer, and they're used in perfumes, shampoos, and lotions to help the product absorb into your skin. Researchers at the University of Washington found that infants had higher concentrations of phthalates in their urine if their mothers used baby lotions, shampoos, and powders. Dr. Sheila Sathyanarayana led the study. She says it can be hard to avoid phthalates.
In terms of personal care products and cosmetics, we don't know. The products are not labeled. to contain phthalates in them. And so it's very, very difficult to kind of counsel families about what to do.
Sathya Narayana says more study is needed to determine human health effects. Animal studies have shown that the chemicals can change hormone levels, leading to reproductive problems in males. For the Environment Report, I'm Mark Brush.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Well, products labeled organic used to be associated with, well, the hippie culture. Ever since the National Organic Standards went into effect 5 years ago, organic has become big business. Sales of organic products now total about $20 billion a year in the U.S. But that quick growth spurt is coming with some growing pains. Julie Grant reports.
Kara Scora is a part-time college professor, and her family doesn't make a lot of money. She's wearing a hand-me-down sweater. She's been eyeing some bracelets at this Target store, but she quickly walks away. She isn't going to spend her money on something so frivolous. Instead, Scora goes to the dairy case and pulls out a carton of organic milk. At $3.50, it's nearly double the price of a regular half gallon. But Scora thinks the higher cost is worth it for her two sons.
Because it's one thing, I mean, we don't go out to dinner, we don't waste money on things, and we don't have much money to spend. But I figured this is becoming their bodies. This is becoming their bones and their flesh and what little fat they have. They're both skinny little boys. So I'm willing to go into debt to get organic milk.
Really go into debt?
Oh, yeah. We're in credit card debt, and I think of a couple thousand dollars of that every year is organic milk. It's the one thing we splurge on.
Scora used to have to go to a health food store to find organic milk. These days, she can buy it a lot of places. And whether she's buying it at Target or someplace else, she trusts that the government's organic label means the milk meets certain standards. It used to be a label that said organic could mean all kinds of things. Different state agencies and private organizations each had their own organic standards. Each trained their own people to inspect farms to make sure farmers were meeting their organization's rules. Then 5 years ago, the U.S. Department of Agriculture launched the National Organic Program. Now the people who inspect organic farms are all looking at the same set of rules, the USDA's national standards. A national standard means farmers know what they need to do to sell milk as organic in every state. So now big dairy farms are churning out organic milk to be shipped out across the nation. Leslie Zuck is director of Pennsylvania Certified Organic, one of the certifiers for the USDA. Zuck says the national program has some problems. The standards aren't always specific, so it can be difficult for certifiers and farmers to know if they're doing the right things. For instance, one big concern is how long dairy cows get to be out on grass.
You go out there and you say, oh, we don't think you have enough pasture. And they say, well, how much is enough? And we say, well, we don't really know, but we don't think you have enough.
Since some rules are a little fuzzy, some certifiers are more lenient than others.
Some certifiers have interpreted that part of the regulation as not really requiring that the cows have pasture all the time and that they really don't have to have a lot of grass to eat. They just have to be out there walking around for a few hours a day.
Zuck says some dairy producers find out which agencies will interpret the standards the way the farmers want and hire those certifiers.
Well, that shouldn't be the case.
Barbara Robinson is USDA administrator of the National Organic Program.
Certifying agents should all be applying the rules in the same way.
Robinson concedes many issues, such as the required amount of pasture, need to be clarified in the national rules. Some environmentalists were appalled that a large dairy producer in Colorado was certified organic. Aurora Farms confined its cows indoors for 9 months out of the year. Robinson says the USDA considered revoking the company's certification, but instead signed an agreement. And she says Aurora Farms has been improving its practices.
I don't have any problems telling consumers who go into a retail market and purchase organic milk at Walmart that they are purchasing properly labeled certified organic milk. They can feel comfortable with that.
And Walmart and Target are exactly the kinds of retailers that Aurora Farms supplies with its organic milk. Meantime, the people who buy that milk say they expect the government to make sure the dairies are living up to the national standards, especially since customers like Kara Skora have to sacrifice so much to pay the higher prices of milk with an organic label. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up in a little bit, we'll take a look at finding abandoned tires and turning them into something useful. But first, tiny single-celled organisms could become the giants of energy production in the near future. Scientists are using bacteria to convert waste into hydrogen energy. Lisa Ann Pinkerton recently watched a vat of microbes turning wastewater into electricity.
More than 17 million gallons of grape juice is sitting in what amounts to be a huge refrigerator. It's Welch's grape juice ready to be bottled. About the size of a gymnasium, the cooler's covered with tile, and the juice is stored in big stainless steel tanks. Paul Zorzi is the plant manager. He says they have to regularly clean the tanks, and first they rinse them with water to clean out the remaining juice.
Juice would typically be anywhere from 10 to 20% sugar, so what goes down the drain might be 0.3.
Since there's still a little bit of grape juice and sugar in that wastewater, it can still be used. Behind the plant, the faint smell of grape juice wafts from a bubbling tank of wastewater. It looks kind of like a purple jacuzzi. And in a nearby shed, Gannon University professor Rick Diz has built a pilot system to convert the sugar in that grape juice wastewater into electricity. With the help of the Ohio biotechnology firm Nanologix, he's coaxing millions of microorganisms to consume the sugar and produce hydrogen.
The sort of bacteria that produce hydrogen and actually other biofuels of one sort or another just love sugar, just like for people, sugar is the easiest thing to digest for many organisms.
Diz says if you keep introducing the food, that sugar from the watered-down grape juice, the microbe population will double every 24 to 48 minutes. He's trying to keep the conditions just right to encourage hydrogen-producing microbes to grow, while at the same time discouraging methane-producing ones. They feed on hydrogen, and it can be a careful balancing act. When the microbes produce enough gas, the pressure trips a switch and the hydrogen is pumped into a slender high-pressure holding tank.
And so far, we've been quite successful. We are, in fact, producing hydrogen gas, and we have used that gas to run an engine that generated electricity for us on just a demonstration purpose.
As you can imagine, there are all sorts of industries that create waste sugar water, from fruit juices and sodas to candy makers. So there's lots of potential to generate hydrogen and then electricity from residual sugar and wastewater. But Diz says the Welch's system is the only one in the U.S. to successfully do this outside of a laboratory setting. The Welch's plant in Erie, Pennsylvania, spends about $1.5 million a year for electricity and wastewater treatment each. It hopes a large-scale project that Diz will build this spring can put a dent in those bills.
Welch's is certainly one of the first companies that we've heard of who's expressed a serious interest in producing hydrogen for microorganisms.
That's Patrick Surface at the National Hydrogen Association. He says developing renewable ways to generate hydrogen is ideal for a greener energy sector, but the methods have to be economically worth it.
And now the trick is to make the leap from the laboratory to real-world applications and using the hydrogen to actually produce real electricity or meet some kind of other energy need.
Surface says if Welch's makes good on its plans to build a large-scale bioreactor, it'll be a major step for renewable hydrogen and an example for the rest of the nation's over 200 beverage makers and bottlers. For the Environment Report, I'm Lisa Ann Pinkerton.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. When you get new tires on your car, you're charged a fee to properly dispose of the old tires. Too often, That doesn't happen. The tires end up being abandoned in vacant lots or thrown into a remote ditch. Zach Rosen reports one group is picking up those tires and making something useful, and at the same time, helping people.
You see, if you can notice, it don't take much to find tires around here. You don't have to go far.
Mike Mason is driving me around in a big white truck, looking for thrown out tires. And we found some, a pretty big pile of old tires.
And see here, you see how they dump them around abandoned buildings?
Who do you think dumped this?
Somebody went somewhere and picked up some tires from a tire shop, and they paid them to get rid of them. Instead of them taking them somewhere, they'll dump them right here.
Abandoned tires are a problem in a lot of cities, and that's the case here on the west side of Detroit. The tire piles are a fire hazard. They're breeding grounds for mosquitoes. They're an environmental disaster. Mason loads a dozen or so tires into the back of the truck. He's taking them to a factory where workers take these problem tires and turn them into something useful. One large room of this multi-purpose factory is used to shred the formerly discarded tires into thick rubber strips. The strips are then hole-punched, fixed together with three metal rods, and designed with colorful plastic beads. The end result is a custom-made doormat made out of recycled tires. This whole venture started when Reverend Faith Fowler came across a magazine article about a Native American tribe making doormats out of old car tires in Oklahoma. She thought, heck, we should be doing this in Detroit.
And it intrigued me because of the number of vacant lots here in the city and the fact that we're dealing with the illegal dumping. We knew we had a bunch of men and women who have been homeless and are having a hard time finding work right now.
Reverend Fowler is the executive director of Cass Community Social Services. That's a center for homeless people and people with addictions. And now she's heading up the new doormat-making business. The people who work here actually live across the street or at another one of Cass's housing programs around the city. Fowler says she's really into this new business model because of all the problems it fights. Unemployment, vacant lots, and illegal dumping.
We set it up as a training program so that for 3 months they work for just 4 hours a day learning sort of the business, if you will. And then at the end of that training time, they can either decide they want to work here or they can take a reference from us to work somewhere else.
This really is a small-scale operation. There are 4 part-time and 3 full-time employees here, making about 25 mats a day.
I don't know if that sounds like a lot or a little.
That's Stacy Lee. She's in charge of supervising the doormat operation. She says the whole point of this business is to work in a place that's not very high stress. There are no quotas here, and all the employees get paid the same thing, no matter how many mats they make in a day.
It's not all about production and bottom line. For us, the bottom line is human beings, so that's where our focus is.
And some of the people making the doormats say the approach makes the difference for them. Before starting work at Cass Community Social Services recently, Devel Davis was having a really hard time finding a job.
I would have jumped on any job I could that was offered to me, but it's just my mental state. When I do work, I let that bother me, and I feel but it's all part of the illness, schizophrenia. And basically when this came along, I was very happy, you know, knowing that I can work and not have any distractions to where it will make me not want to work. So I like it here.
Now, no one is making a lot of money by any means, but Reverend Faith Fowler says it's making a difference for the people and for the environment. More than 1,000 mats have now been made. That means more than 2,000 discarded tires that were illegally dumped are now welcoming people into their homes. For the Environment Report, I'm Zach Rosen.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham, wondering when the government's rhetoric about cleaner energy will be matched by action. Mark Brush is my co-editor. His report on phthalates is the latest of several we've done on these chemicals. The concern is growing because phthalates are found in so many products, from cosmetics and personal care to all kinds of plastics that we use daily. Rebecca Williams is our chief reporter. We'll be hearing about zoos and their efforts to save toads, frogs, and other amphibians from being wiped out. Amphibians are being annihilated at a rate that's never been seen in Earth's history. We've got photos of the Welch's bioreactor and bios of some of the reporters you heard, as well as links to more information on all the stories at environmentreport.org. And if you want to drop us a line, talk about grape juice eating bacteria, organic milk, and whatever that means, the president's environmental and energy policy, or you just want to let us know about a story we ought to be covering but we haven't yet, our email address is feedback@environmentreport.org. The Environment Report is a tiny little division of Michigan Public Media.
Support for Environment Report stories comes from the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Americana Foundation. Get more information about Environment Report stories at environmentreport.org.